I'm talking today about sibling rivalry, and what we'll try to do is I'll try to present for, you can, or all right, fine, we can probably, latecomers, we'll leave some over here, people will show up late. Okay, I'm going to talk in general, Tom, let me just give you the overview, okay, I'm going to talk in general what the purpose or function of sibling rivalry is. In fact, my approach will probably be a little bit surprising. Some of you may be familiar with probably the most popular book on sibling rivalry, which is called Siblings Without Rivalry, or even this title, Overcoming Sibling Rivalry. What I hope to accomplish, if I'm successful, is to convince you that's not correct. There should be sibling rivalry, that sibling rivalry is normal. And I always get like a lot of like people wiping their brow when I say that. The point is not to have siblings without rivalry. The point is to have siblings with manageable rivalry. And more importantly, and that's what we're going to hopefully accomplish, I want to show you that the experience of sibling rivalry and the proper parental management of sibling rivalry is growth-inducing. We need sibling rivalry. We learn very important lessons about life by fighting with our siblings. So you're not going to walk out of here coming home and ending all the fighting and conflict between your kids. What you're going to hopefully do is understand why it's occurring and what you can do so that it becomes a positive experience. Now, there is abnormal sibling rivalry. There is rivalry that's inappropriate. Now, we'll talk a little bit about that, or some sibling rivalry that should be maybe addressing some problems and should be stopped and corrected, etc., and I will discuss that as well. Okay, but the main point will be to have siblings with rivalry. I always try to start off with some sort of amusing anecdote, so I think the one that always comes to my mind and I draw from my own experience was when my second child was born. And at the time, my oldest child was about 2.5 or something like that, 2.5, 3 years old. And we took her to the hospital, and you know how it is, they line up all the kids. And I picked her up and I pointed over there and I said, "You see that one over there? That's your brother." And then she looked and then she pointed to the kid next to him and said, "I like that one better." She didn't waste a minute's time. So hey, how you doing? So we got her that one, you know, 5 pounds girl, you know, she thought she was shopping, and so we purchased her that one. But that's sort of, I guess, the thrust of the cartoon, where the young boy, when the parents come home with the kids, say, "I hope you kept the box it came in." Okay, but let's go back, and I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask it sort of like in a double negative, so I hope you get the question. But how many people here, no, I'll say it once, I'll ask it again, how many of you here can say that your siblings, while growing up, that your relationships with your siblings did not have an effect on who you are today? In other words, that your relationship with your siblings had no impact on who you are today. Can anybody say that? No. See? Your relationships with your siblings very much shaped who you are today. And it's a very interesting thing, because this aspect of our development really gets shortchanged. You'll hear endless stuff about how our parents affected us. In fact, today, you'll hear endlessly about how the internet and school and culture and music and television affect you. You'll hear very little about how relationships with siblings affect you. There's very little in the literature. So it really does not get the attention it deserves. And yet, as I said, very few people could honestly say that they are, you know, help yourself to one of these when you come in, okay? That they are not affected by their relationship with their siblings. And in fact, and I don't want to sermonize too much, you know what Beryl Wine says, God save us from rabbis who think they're businessmen and businessmen who think they're rabbis. But if you look at the Chumash, and you look at the Bereishis, and the Avos, and the world events that occurred, and how much relationships between siblings shaped what happened, and shaped world events. If you look at an Esav and a Yaakov, a Yitzhak and Yishmael, Yosef and his brothers, and I'm not trying to say that the issues between Yosef and the Shiftei Ka were, you know, the same kind of petty things that our children fight about. It wasn't over toys and how much attention you get. But still, sibling relationships, and for that matter, sibling conflict, shaped world history. And to this day, we are feeling the impact of those sibling relationships. So we see how important sibling relationships are. I debated with myself whether I'm going to do this, but I am going to actually share with you a Hamik Dover I saw. That'll be the last thing I'll do that was sermonic, that I think really sums this up. You all know the situation when Yaakov and Esav finally reunite. Esav wanted to kill Yaakov. He's going to murder him. There was incredible tension. He was all prepared for a war. finally they meet. There's that moment that they've been waiting for. And, see if I have in the right place. Here we go. Good, I'm glad I prepared this. Here we go. Vayaretz Esav likraso. Esav ran to greet him. Vayechab bekehu. And Esav embraced him. Vayipolal tzavarav. And Esav fell on his shoulders. Vayishakehu. And Esav kissed him. This is all Esav right now, right? Then it says Vayivku. And they cried. Now Yaakov's included. Listen to Nahami Dover. It's very short, but it's incredible. It says Shneim Bachu. They both cried. It's the first time Yaakov is doing something. That at this moment, Yaakov had love for Esav. Right? The man who was going to kill him, the man who had this fierce competition, at that moment he loved him. And he says, and so it's going to be for all generations. When the descendants of Esav recognize us for who we are and our greatness, then we have to reciprocate because Esav is our brother. Now, I remember I had chills when I read this. You see what he's saying? If the nations of the world come around finally and recognize us for who we are, we have to forget the pogroms, we have to forget the crusades, we have to forget the blood libels, we have to forget the Holocaust, and we have to love them because that's the nature of relationships between siblings, and they are our siblings. That's sibling relationships. So what function does sibling relationships serve? So let me put it in the general context, and then we'll talk about specific ones. In general, and I often say this, and I'm sure I'm saying that's fairly evident to everybody, childhood is a laboratory for adulthood. Everything that happens in childhood is preparing children for adulthood. Anytime you as parents have to decide what to do, how to approach a certain behavior that a child is engaging in, the best criteria is to fast forward to adulthood, make believe he's an adult, and would this behavior, that behavior, be conducive to his growth? Would this be good for him? If it is, and that's the intervention you do. Because during childhood, we learn how to cope with the world. Therefore, for example, discipline, let's say, and it's not the topic here. Why do we discipline children? Because out there in the world, you don't get everything you want. You have to learn how to live with limits. If we don't discipline children, if we don't limit what they can get, they won't be able to cope with life. So therefore, we discipline them, not because of revenge, not to make our lives easier, to prepare them for life. Now, in this big world that they're going to be living in, or that we live in as adults, we have different kinds of relationships. We have what are called hierarchical relationships, which are relationships between people that we're not on the same level with. So we have relationships with bosses, we have relationships with parents, we have relationships with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with God. That's a hierarchical relationship. The childhood laboratory for those relationships are our relationships with our parents. By learning to deal with our parents, we learn how to deal with teachers, we learn how to deal with bosses, we learn how to deal with authority, we learn how to deal with the IRS. You know, this is because we learn how to relate to authority. So everything we do as parents, in many respects, are preparing our children for those relationships. But there's another whole arena of relationships that we have, which is relationships with our contemporaries, relationships with our peers, with our neighbors, with our fellow members of shul, with our partners, not our superior, our bosses, but our partners, our fellow workers at work. And that is learned from our relationship with siblings. Siblings is the laboratory where we learn to engage, to interact with our contemporaries. So a lot of what goes on between brothers and sisters are really attempts to understand, deal, and cope with some of the lessons, or some aspects of life with contemporaries. So I say here, in fact, and that's again, if I follow the model here, we don't want siblings without rivalry. We want siblings with rivalry, but we want to use that to teach them lessons. Now, I'm going to propose to you that there are basically two important lessons that we learn from our siblings or from our interactions with our siblings. One of them is we learn conflict resolution. And by the way, these will have some bearing on how we handle or treat these situations. Okay, there are handouts here, by the way. So you're going to take a test afterwards. I mentioned the test, right? And the homework and... No, oh, okay. Yeah. I'm in a classroom here, and it just sort of brings it out in me. So here, pass them around. It's worth it because there's a cute cartoon on it. You know, it's not the rest of it you can throw out. You can cut out the cartoon and throw out the rest, you know. Okay. Right, okay. I should have a monitor. Okay, you want to be the monitor? Okay. All right, here we go. Okay. All right. So Mrs. Kelden is the monitor, okay? Now, okay, two important. One lesson is conflict resolution. How do we resolve conflicts with contemporaries? Not with authority. In other words, not how do we deal with something when we're running with our boss. That we learn about with our parents. But what happens if we're not getting along with our business partner? What happens if we're not getting along with our neighbor? What happens if a friend of ours very much disappoints us? What happens, most importantly perhaps, when we have a conflict with our spouse? Who's our contemporary? Who's our peer? How do we know how to resolve that? How do we know how to get beyond it? Well, we practice, the laboratory for that is our brother and sister. When we fight with them, when we beat them up, when they kick at us or we kick them, we're trying to figure out how to resolve these differences. So the one key lesson that kids are learning from, that's what I'm saying, they have to have the rivalry. Because sometimes you have to create the problem in order for them to learn how to resolve. For example, I'll just give you an example. Some of you may have had kids event and your recess who had bedwetting at nighttime. And there are many techniques to deal with it. One of the techniques is a behavioral technique, and in order to do it, you give the kid a lot to drink before he goes to sleep, because he has to have the experience of needing to go to the bathroom at night. So you create the problem so they can figure out the solution. So the conflict is there so the kid can learn how to solve. So one thing we're teaching them is how do you resolve difficulties? How do you solve conflict? The second lesson of sibling rivalry is something that probably, hopefully, most of us so take for granted that we forget sometimes how we learned it. And that is basically that life is not fair. And from our perspective, life is not fair. Now, granted, upstairs, everything is fair, but we don't understand that. But not everybody has the same. Some people are wealthier than other people. Some people have better children. Some people have better health. Some people are better looking. There are inequities. Some people are smarter. There are inequities in life. And somehow or another, we all cope with that. We somehow worked it out and make our peace with that. We're able to do that because we've struggled with it as children, and we struggle with our siblings. So when your kid comes to you and says, "Not fair, you gave him more," or something like that. I remember my father when I was a kid used to say that he has to count the bubbles in the Pepsi Cola. You know, when there's that sense of inequity, when the kids come complaining, and sometimes you're bewildered yourself. I mean, how much more fair can you be? They're struggling with this. They're just realizing that there are inequities in life, and they have to somehow cope with it. And the fact that we today can live next door to somebody who's driving a nicer car, who has a bigger house, and we cope with it, and may bother us a little bit, but we basically can cope with it. We have a way of somehow explaining it away so it doesn't get to us, because we practice this as kids with our siblings. So those are the two key lessons of sibling rivalry. One is conflict resolution. How do you resolve difficulties? How do you resolve conflicts? And two, to deal with the reality, the bitter pill, swallow the bitter pill, that life is not always fair. Now, this has bearing on how we deal with these issues. I feel bad, there are no chairs. There's some chairs here. Okay. Here, one second. I'm not sitting down. So, help yourself. Are you sitting over there? Okay, fine, if anybody else comes. Okay. Just don't let me sit down. Okay. So by our ability to come to terms with that, as I said, that bitter pill, did I get less? Did I have to get a note from your parents? Do you have a note from your mother? You're late. Huh? Okay.
No, not yet.
Not yet? Okay, see me after class. Okay. All right. This is why I don't get invited back too often, you know. Okay. So the fact that the kids can cope with this bitter pill, can cope with this reality, is dealt with by the conflict that occurs or by the struggles. Okay, so what bearing does this have in terms of our way of managing or coping with sibling rivalry? So let me give you a few pointers. First of all, you can never be 100% fair. You shouldn't try to be 100% fair. Obviously, you shouldn't show obvious favoritism. And we'll talk later when something like that happens. But generally speaking, you cannot be 100% fair, and you can't be 100%. And in fact, if it was possible, like I said, my father said that you could count the bubbles in the Pepsi Cola. If you really could count the bubbles in the Pepsi Cola and make it out equally, you would be doing your child a disservice, because that's not life. In life, things are unfair. And I'm just not saying you shouldn't engineer inequity, but invariably, there will be unfairness. On a certain day, one kid's going to have a birthday party, he's going to be lavished with gifts, and the other kid's going to get a little token something or another. It's not fair. okay? Or an older child will be allowed to sleep, go to sleep later, will be allowed to stay with a friend overnight, and the other one's not. It's not fair, and that's the battle cry of all kids. It's not fair. Well, yeah, it's not fair, and that's something you have to learn how to cope with. And if a parent bends themselves over backwards and engages in all sorts of acrobatics to try to make everything 100% fair, they're not preparing their child for life. So to a certain extent, and you don't, as I said, you don't have to engineer it. It will happen naturally. But the natural inequities that occur, you have to allow the child to make their peace with it and come to terms with it. And I'll tell you some fairly obnoxious things that I do, which is probably why my children don't talk to me anymore. But I know that one of the things that my kids come to me and say, well, you know, the cones let their kids sleep, stay up till 11 o'clock at night. So I tell them, you have to understand the difference between cones and the Blumenthal. The cones love their children. It puts an end to it, you know. Sometimes when the kids come to me complaining, you gave him more, I love him more, you know, and it really puts an end to everything, my whole relationship with them. But the point is, by the way, there's one more thing you should know about. There's a chair here.
There's a chair here.
Yeah, right. You can sit on the floor. All right. There's a garbage can. Okay. Now, in fact, I want to tell you that I have these diagnoses for kids that I want to make up myself. And one of them is that called delusions of unanimity, which is otherwise known as the everybody else's parents lets them syndrome, which means that your kids come home and everybody else's parents let them do something that you don't let them do. The reason why everybody else's parents let them do it, because their kids are telling them that you let them, their kids do it. And one of the things I encourage parents, I mean, it's a little bit not related to this subject, but it does have to do with this fairness issue, is you understand that your kids are in school all day plotting how to undermine you. And that's all they do, right? We never talk to other parents. You have an issue with something, whatever it may be, call your kid, the classmate's parents. You'll be surprised how many of them agree with you, but are buckling under the pressure because their kids are telling them that you allow it. So we have to communicate. But sometimes it will happen that some parents are more lenient than other parents. Sometimes there will be difference. Sometimes you can't get it together. I often mention this story. I was in Los Angeles about 3 years ago, and I was presenting in a modern Hebrew day school, and I was talking about, the topic was entertainment. And I blasted what was very popular at the time, the so-called professional wrestling, which is like, you know what they say about the Holy Roman Empire? That wasn't holy, wasn't Roman, wasn't an empire. It's not professional, it's not wrestling. It's a barbaric display of violence and unsportsmanlike conduct. And afterwards, a parent came to me and said, I'm so glad you said that. My kid watches it, and I can't stand it, but he says everybody else in the class watches it, so I have to let him do it. Another parent came to me and said, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I hate it, but everybody else in the class. Before you know it, I had 10 parents together, and they agreed as a unit to answer this one show. It's very powerful if you can get together. But again, still there will be inequities. And you can't make it fair, and you can't make it even. And it is okay, within reason, to say, they allow it, I don't. We don't have to use necessarily my line, but you can somehow say, we have different standards. And they have to cope with that because they will be coping invariably as they grow up with these kind of inequities. In terms of conflict resolution, again, I'm saying one of the lessons and one of the things kids learn to do from their relationships with siblings is to work out differences, which will later on be useful in settings where there will be conflict between contemporaries. And there, the old maxim, less is more, becomes applicable. The less involved you get involved in it, the less you're meddling, the better off you are. You have to put the onus of responsibility to work out their differences on the kids because these are skills they need. You know, the Gemara says, "Ad marotzav kav shalom yitishu kavim shal chavero," that somebody wants something they gain themselves more than what's given to them. What the child develops himself by creating the context where the kid himself can learn these skills is going to be far more useful than you're doing it for them. There will be times when you may have to. But the first line of attack should be to let the kids work it out between themselves and to create a context where they have to work it out between themselves. So let me give you some examples. Kids are fighting over a toy. You had it yesterday, you had it today, or they're fighting over time in the computer. That's probably more common today. Right? You got it then, you got it here, you got it there, you know, they're measuring every second, etc. You get several different versions. You have no idea. Right? Oh, by the way, one more thing also. Never try to figure out who started. If there's such a thing in this world as yesh me'ayin, or spontaneous combustion at sibling rivalry, there's no way to figure out who started. They just kind of look at each other, and they're off and running. And if you're going to try to figure out who started, you're going to be busy with that, you're never going to figure it out. But again, you put the onus of responsibility on them. One approach would be to say, you know what? We're shutting down the computer, and when you two can figure out how to share it, it'll go back on. You'll be surprised how quickly they come up to it with a solution. And now you've given them techniques. You've taught them how to compromise. You've taught them how to negotiate, which is a life skill. I'll tell you one more thing, again, something I've done. I want to first of all share a secret with you that's not commonly well known. Car manufacturers put something in the ventilation system of cars that make kids want to kill each other. It's a well-known secret, but there is something there, and as soon as you get into the car, it's World War II. So you get yourself one of these like 15-seat vans for your three children, you know, with barriers and security checks between them, and somehow or another they're able to span those barriers and get into fights. There's something about a car that makes them one of the techniques that I did, which my kids were younger, which was very effective. When the fighting started, I pulled over to the side. I said, we'll continue on our trip when the fighting ends. Now, that created a problem on the George Washington Bridge. I'll admit it. You know, it was a bit of a problem. You know, you'd hear the INS traffic report. Oh, Blumenfeld's kids are fighting. There's a backup on the George Washington Bridge. But where possible, that was it. I didn't get involved. I'm not going to try to figure out who started. I'm not going to try to figure out who's right, who's wrong, etc. Work it out yourselves. Figure it out yourselves. That is the ideal. And as much as you can do that, you are helping your children, and that's why they need to get back to the original theme. That's why you need sibling rivalry. In fact, by the way, and I think I forgot to mention it earlier, research shows that sibling rivalry is actually a sign of a normal home. That sometimes in the siblings, not always, but sometimes in the siblings sort of cling to each other, it's a problematic home. The difficulty, so the siblings look for some of the stuff they should be getting from parents from each other. So the fact that kids are killing each other is probably a sign that you have a normal home. Not necessarily, but that's it. So you should have the rivalry, because the rivalry creates a context where they can learn these very important skills, which is in how to resolve difficulties. Can we save questions till the end? Because my Ritalin's going to wear off. So if you can just wait a minute, all right? And that can work out these differences. Now, I'm going to try to anticipate some of the questions, okay? Oh, my God, I got to move. Okay. You're going to say, well, sometimes they can't, right? What happens if it just gets out of hand and you can't resolve them? Then as little as possible. You can get involved, but you have to get involved with the concept, with the idea that you're not going to solve it. You're going to help them as much as possible solve it. So if it's really, you know, you've taken away the computer and you've taken away all their toys and, you know, and now they all get is bread and water, you know, and they're still killing each other, so you have to come up with something. Then you can offer them solutions. You can say, why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? That would be like a second line of attack. If they just can't do it themselves, now you're going to give them not a solution, you're not going to solve the problem for them, you're not going to buy each person their own computer. Again, that would be depriving them of the opportunity to learn how to share. But you might give them some technique. You might say, you know, why don't you try 1 hour here, 1 hour there? Why don't you have Monday one person, Tuesday the other person? See if you can give them ways in which they can solve difficulties. Why don't each of you write down, go back to your room, okay? Why don't we, after we've put the cast on and we've gotten you to the orthopedist and we've taken care of your wounds, go back to your room and write down potential solutions and let's see what happens. If it's literally you can't, then you can sometimes dictate a solution. But if you come to that point, let's say again, you say, okay, this is the rule. You know, from so-and-so time, so-and-so time, the person used the computer, from so-and-so time, so-and-so time, this person used the computer. If it comes to that point, then then you have to at least convey to them, okay, you see what I did? You see there's a lesson here. You see that by I was able to come up with some sort of solution. Let's see next time if you can do that. But again, put the onus of responsibility as much as possible on them. Okay, let me talk a few minutes about some of the atypical situations and some of the do's and don'ts, and then we'll have some time for some questions, rebuttals. You can throw things if you want, that's fine. First of all, do not order your children to love another child. You can't order love. Love has to come spontaneously. And if you demand affection and love, you're guaranteeing that you're not going to get it, because it's like telling a kid to do something that doesn't come naturally. You don't tell the kid it's okay to hate your brother and sister. Whatever feelings you have, You know, you don't have to get into that, but when you say, well, you must love your child, or if you say, well, look how wonderfully I get along with my siblings, overlooking the fact that you used to hospitalize each other regularly when you were younger. But in fact, by the way, it's a nice thing to tell kids sometimes when they get very upset. If you can, if you happen to have a nice, you know, a warm relationship with your siblings, you can say, you know, we as kids used to fight a lot also. And this way you're modeling something, you're showing them, you know, you can grow up and get along. But don't tell them they have to love the kid. Okay. Be very careful about scapegoating. Okay, now scapegoating is something, I'm sure you all know what it is. It really comes from the Chumash, it's the Eiz LaZazel. Scapegoating is, you know, the old kick the dog phenomena. You had a miserable day at work, or something else is happening in your life that is very frustrating, and you have that pent-up frustration and anger, and you take it out on the first person you see or the most vulnerable person you see. Now, that can occur with kids as well. A kid who is, let's say, a very typical example, a kid who is getting, oh, no, you didn't bring the makeup artist this time. Okay. You didn't bring the makeup artist, was he? Okay. All right. Sorry. Okay, I missed it. Okay. You know, a kid, typical example is a kid who's being ostracized by peers. Kid that's being picked on and he's, you know, for whatever reason, he doesn't have great social skills, he's not doing well with his peer group. And he comes home and the first thing he sees is his kid brother, and everything he wants to do to all those bullies in the school, he's going to take out on the kid brother. So sometimes you have to be careful when, especially in extreme types of conflict and sibling rivalry, maybe there's displacement, maybe there's scapegoating. Scapegoating, by the way, is so natural that they actually see it in the animal kingdom. They've done studies where they... Oh, I actually do have time. I was looking at the second hand. Okay. Okay. They've done studies where they took rats, I think it was. We torture rats in psychology. They took rats and they just senselessly tortured them. They just like electrocuted them for no reason. And then they threw in like these doll rats, these toy rats. And the rats literally ripped the toys apart. They attacked them out of the frustration. So if you see this kind of extreme type of like atypical sibling rivalry, something you have to wonder about is there other things going on for all the kids or for one particular kid who may be provoking it that is causing this to occur? Let me talk a little bit about favoritism. Now, it's an interesting question. You know, everybody always gets asked the question, you know, do you love me more? You love this one more? I told you my answer is very simple. You know, or I sometimes tell my kids I don't have any favoritism. I hate you all the same. I have my stand lines, but you know, there is a question. Kids, well, first of all, every kid always feels that the other sibling is loved more. That's very natural, okay? So don't worry about that. However, it does occur sometimes. I don't think anybody really loves one kid more than the other. I don't think that's really possible. However, what is possible is that one kid is just somehow or another easier to get along with or is just less demanding, you know, than another child. I mean, one of the myths of parenting is that all kids are equally easy to raise. Just not true. You get some kids, you know, as soon as they're born, you wind them up and they just go through life producing nachas. And then there are other kids that eat your kishkas out every step of the way. Those are the ones who usually become mental health professionals when they grow up. Kids are different. Kids have different temperaments. Kids are different in terms of even their likability or their manageability. Not only that, but we have come to recognize that every child, just like we're born with different physical attributes, we're born with different personalities, different temperaments. Some kids, and this is something that nurses and in any neonatal unit will tell you, that every baby, as soon as they're born, cries differently. Some shriek and scream, others, you know, sort of whimper. Kids are different. They have different personalities. They get this personality, this temperament, from their parents, from the DNA of the parents. It's entirely possible that one particular child resembles one parent more than another. And I'm not talking about even physically. I'm talking about in terms of just personality, temperament, etc. So you may resonate with a particular child more than another one. It just, that child resembles you. That child kind of interacts in the world the way you did. If you were, let's say, a very compliant, easygoing kind of person, and you have this kid who's very compliant, easygoing, has your genes, so you resonate with that kid. Meanwhile, the other one has your husband's genes, and he's difficult, and he's angry all the time, and he's ornery. You know, so your husband may resonate with that kid more. That's not necessarily loving the child more or not, but we do, and you'll see this in families, and parents, again, for people large, I'm going to tell you, certain kids are just easier to relate to, parent, etc. You have to be careful about that. The likelihood is that the other kid may have the husband's genes, and maybe the husband will be better. And there's nothing wrong. It doesn't make you less of a good parent if you happen to relate better to one sibling and the other parent happens to relate well to that other sibling. But you have to be cognizant of that, and have to be cognizant that sometimes that can create a sense or a perception of favoritism. Okay. One more thing. Again, it's a question I get asked a lot, which is an interesting thing, is how different sometimes siblings are from one another. That especially contiguous siblings, especially siblings that are born one right after the other. Now, let me just address that for a minute and explain it and put in a... You can come in, by the way. You don't have to... Okay. No, stay out. Yeah, it's better. Yeah. Come in. Inside. Everybody... We have many needs. We have need for food and for affection and for intellectually we have needs, curiosity, to have to be intellectually stimulated. We also have a need to be unique. We have a basic inherent need to be distinct. I'm going to talk about that a little later in the next thing I'm talking about in terms of religious differences between parents and children. But that's a basic human need. In fact, ad kedei kach, that in settings where people are tortured, in settings where they want to undermine people's self-esteem, they undo the differences. So you have, in prisons, etc., you have uniforms, or in Beis Yaakov's. No, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said. Okay. But, you undo their individuality. That's a form of torture. In fact, if you read of people who have been in these kind of settings, in concentration camps, and prisoners, in prisons, etc., they will sometimes go risk their lives to somehow assert their individuality. The same thing happens with siblings. Very often, the sibling right beneath the next one, the one up, looks at that kid and says, this is who I'm not going to be. They somehow have to assert their autonomy. And that's okay. That's normal. It's natural, etc. And be very careful, therefore, then when you say, why can't you be like such and such and such and such? It's very hard when you're always being compared. So if you have a sibling who's the valedictorian and the superstar, oh, you're so-and-so. And right away you put in front of the class and you're not so exceptional. Well, you'll assert your exceptionality in other areas. So again, that's natural, and the task in terms of parenting is to appreciate each kid for their particular natias, for their particular strengths, and not to, as much as possible, not to engage in comparing. In fact, if I can share with you one very interesting study, I'll be done in about 5 minutes. There was a study done. There's been an interest in recent years in psychology, the whole area of happiness, what makes people happy. Some very interesting findings, very commensurate with what we learned from in Sifrei Musar, etc. But there was one very interesting study. If you can concentrate for a minute, it was very interesting. What they did was they brought a bunch of people together, and they gave them a task to do. They gave them some sort of task to do. And they had in the room with the person doing the task a confederate, in other words, someone from the study. So, although the person didn't know that, as far as they were concerned, the other person was also being studied. And no matter how well the person did, the guy next to them did better. So if the person got a 95, the guy next to them got a 99. The person got a 65, the guy next to them got a 70. But whatever it was, proportionately, the person next to them always did better. Now listen to what they found. They found that happy people, inherently happy people, who did poorly on the task, walked away more content than unhappy people who did well, because the guy next to them did better. Unhappy people compare, happy people have a certain smechem b'chelkem. So we have to appreciate each kid, try as much as possible, appreciate each kid for their distinctness, and there's nothing wrong with even highlighting their distinctness, that's okay to be distinct from one another. Okay, some areas of problems, some problematic areas. Sibling rivalry is natural, is normal. Kids, when they fight, know just how far to go. I remember for many years, I was a psychologist in a school. And it happened to be the school where my kids go, which was really tough. By the way, the two things you should never see in your kid's school if you want to live a long life, if you don't want to have high blood pressure. One of them is called recess, and the other one is called dismissal. It's Avami Secha Shebachal Yamimon. You have 800 kids leaving a building, going to these identical yellow buses, everyone going in different, and they're all in the poem. It's really a nace every single day. I mean, and recess is unbelievable. You're having these tiny little yards, hundreds of kids, they're all running in different directions, they're knocking each other over, balls are falling in people's heads, etc. Teacher blows a whistle, they all come back in one piece. It's really a nace. It's really incredible. But I had to sometimes observe children, I was dealing with a kid who may have some social skills problem, I had to observe a kid in recess. And as far as the kids were concerned, I was just one more teacher monitoring recess. And it struck, sometimes you'd see kids get into a fight, especially the boys. And the interesting thing is they know just how far to go. They know where to hit. They know when to stop, except for the kids with problems. It's like there's sort of like a restraint with the fighting. The same thing is true with siblings, especially boys. Well, girls are plenty nowadays also. It'll get physical. But they should know just how far to go. If kids are really hurting each other, if it's that extreme, then there's something wrong. Then you have to maybe intervene, or maybe you have to look if there's some sort of displacement of tension from other settings as well. But normal sibling rivalry, there's sort of a built-in, it's like a braking system, built-in with regard to the fighting. The other point is that you should see, most sibling rivalry should occur, as I said earlier, with the contiguous siblings. It should be the siblings close in age. It is not typical or normal for a 14-year-old to have active sibling rivalry with a 4-year-old. They'll get on each other's nerves. The 4-year-old will touch his stuff. You know, there will be displeasure. For sure the kid will feel that you favor the 4-year-old. That's okay. But this kind of bickering, fighting that you're going to get between a 6- and an 8-year-old, you shouldn't have with kids when there's that much of an age span. If that is going on, that may be indicative of other problems. That's not the normal, natural kind of sibling rivalry. And one more issue I'll bring up, and then we'll have a few minutes just for some give and take. You have to be very careful, especially in certain circumstances, of parentifying a child. That's a term, it's a psychological term, I don't think you find it in Webster, but that means turning a child into an adult, which in certain settings can happen. I'll tell you just one cute little story. A number of years ago, they translated an IQ test into Yiddish for the Haredi community in Yerushalayim, I think, or Bnei Brak, I don't remember, but it was in Israel. And the way IQ testing works is you have to have common responses. You ask a question, you want the kid to give the response that most kids will give. And they got two responses that were totally discrepant with the general population. One, which has no bearing on this, was the question is called test called similarities. In Hebrew, we call it tzad hashava b'neihem. You know, you give two things and how are they similar. So the question was, how's an elbow and knee alike? And you want to guess what they said? How's an elbow and knee alike? That's the correct response, general response. What did they say in the Haredi community? No? You have to cover them both. Right, that was the common response. You have to cover them both. And the other one was, what do you do if you see a child, a young child on the street, crying without a parent present? I want to guess what they said. The answer was, look for the older sister. Which is very telling. But anyway, but you have to be careful about parent, especially in situations if there's a single parent. Or not only if there's a single parent, if there's a situation where there is one parent who's not present enough. What might be a situation that's less obvious is a situation where, let's say, the husband/father is working very hard. We have huge expenses in our community. We have many who are working extremely hard to make ends meet and are hardly ever home. And in the absence of a spouse, to take part, usually the oldest sibling, and make them parent-like. And then the siblings' interactions with the other children is more parental. And it's understandable. It's very understandable. First of all, it's an extra hand. Second of all, if it's where there isn't a parent present, it's almost natural that you want that partner. You have something, there's a void. There's something very much missing in your life. Turn to a kid. You have to be very careful, especially if you're in those kind of circumstances, not to do that to the child. That the kid should be a kid. The kid should be fighting with siblings. Don't sort of make them into a parent. Just think if there's anything else. Yeah. One more thing you have to be just careful about is, again, if there's a stressor in the family, if there's something that is preoccupying your time or taking you away, taxing you, lo aleinu, a child is sick, or if there's huge financial pressures or something of that sort, or if there's a parent that's ill. Sometimes then again, children don't allow themselves to be children. There's a realization that they can't be. They don't have that luxury. Or for that matter, sometimes the resentment towards the sibling is now suddenly that is infused with a great deal of guilt. I mean, I do some work, and nobody should know from it, but the area of parental loss, and sometimes what happens to the sibling is if a child, again, Rahman al-Islam, if a child dies, the kid feels terribly guilty because they probably wished him dead a few times, and kids can confuse wishes with reality. We have, again, what circumstances are circumstances, and you have to do the best you can when there's crisis situations, but as much as possible, you have to let kids be kids, and you have to prevent the situation, even though it might make our lives easier, where a kid falls into a different role, becomes parental-like. They should be children as much as we can, and they should be bickering and fighting. Okay, that leaves us about 10, 15 minutes for some question and answer. Go ahead. Yeah. Oh, you had a question earlier. You want to? I already answered it, right? Or you forgot it. Huh? Yeah, he did. Yeah, I heard. Yeah. So it's okay to kill your sibling. Okay.
He didn't even address that.
Huh? Okay. My point was, we see from day one. One of the comedians once said, we all got upset that our children don't listen to us. So look at God. It's stressed that our children didn't listen to him either. You know, it just how important sibling relations are from day one. Absolutely. 100%. Yeah, go ahead.
What do you do, Lev, if your child didn't outgrow, like you said, the sibling rivalry? I have twins, and my child that was displaced as the youngest in the family was 5.5 years apart. Twins are now 10, she's now 15 and a half, and they hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to be their mother, she wants to boss around. She still feels resentment because they're mm-hmm. they were unique at that point. It just doesn't work. When I leave them together, I know how I come home to World War III.
Right, right.
And it's 15 and a half, I mean, it's 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's not brilliant.
15 and 10. Okay. First, you know, you remind me of Rodney Dangerfield's routine about how his twin brother always forgets his birthday. Okay. None of them, then they remember each other's birthdays? Okay. A 15 and a 10-year-old, it's not, I wouldn't say they should have outgrown it necessarily yet. It's not, 15 and 10 are still pretty, can be pretty juvenile. I think what you're raising is that it's the same thing that comes up again and again later on, and that it's so prolonged that they haven't made any progress with it. There's another thing, by the way, you should know, and that's relevant to this, and I'm sure all of you know this in terms of not only necessarily siblings, but in terms of friends, that odd numbers never work out well, that even numbers always work out better, because in the odd numbers, there's always going to be one excluded. So that's kind of natural. But so I would tell you that a 15 and 10-year-old still going at each other is not that abnormal. What may be of concern is that it's continuing and perpetuating. And it may speak then to some insecurities that the 15-year-old is feeling that is putting on this. And I would tell you then at that point, I don't want to go into specifics about your 15-year-old, but you need then to consider whether there's something else that's being put onto the 10-year-olds in terms of self-esteem importance, in terms of self-perception, et cetera. And that may be not so much because of a 15, 10-year-old, but because it has the same theme for 10 years and they haven't made any headway.
They're still unique.
Well, you're saying something else. You're saying that she's jealous. You're not saying she's jealous because they're smarter or they're prettier or they're... She's saying she's jealous because she's excluded, that they have this special kinship and she's excluded. So the theme for her is being excluded. And why that's still perpetuating itself and why that's still lasting so long, I don't want to go into details, but it would be kedai to look at that from that perspective. I mean, they tell you, the kids, in terms of what the themes are. Again, if we're talking about the kind of sibling rivalry which has, not the normal one, which is a displacement of some other issues, the nature of the theme of the rivalry will give you a clue. It's like detective work. Give you a clue as to what's troubling them. So it has something to do with feeling excluded, but I can't tell you much beyond that. Yeah, go ahead.
Does sibling rivalry ever stop, or does it carry through?
120th birthday. Your 120th birthday. Yeah, I think it continues even then. Yeah, huh?
Into adulthood.
It can. Normal sibling rivalry doesn't. The normal kind of stuff that I talked about earlier, where if the kids work it out, figure it out, it shouldn't continue. If it does continue, then there's deeper underpinnings. But it does very often, very often. I mean, there are many situations. Siblings I know in my practice, siblings who don't talk to each other, have nothing to do with each other, who can't be around each other. And sometimes it's because it taps into something either very old and unresolved, you know, it's still like bubbling, like a volcano that hasn't erupted. Yeah, it could be, but it can absolutely continue into adulthood. But that's not the normal one that I'm talking about earlier. Yeah, go ahead.
My oldest child is my daughter. She's 3 years older than my next child, who's my son. She's been parentified.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to.
Oh, thanks. Okay, is alcoholic?
I've been telling her many times, you know. Their bigger sister, the mother and will be there at the dining room table, Shabbos, what have you, and she's there disciplining them, you know, telling them he shouldn't be doing this, or that's chutzpah, or what mm-hmm. have you, and, you know, we can't constantly head-on deal with every single thing, infraction our child does, mm-hmm. so sometimes we choose to sit things out, because we just, you know, we don't want to constantly be, you know, like that, and if she sees that we're not doing something, she'll take over. So it's like having two mothers, which God forbid nobody wants.
Mm-hmm.
And
most of us don't want one.
Trying to get her to stop. Uh-huh. But she won't listen. But then I still need her because my husband's always working. And moreover, his mother has Alzheimer's. She lives in another state. He's going there now every week trying to get that whole thing.
This is so common in our community because we are so overextended, overstressed. I mean, and very often it is the father who, again, we're not talking about a situation where there's there's widowhood or a divorce on that, but the father's barely, and when he comes home, he's so wiped out, he can't have a problem.
I mean,
that's a very, very common problem. The only thing I would tell you about something like this is you may need to look at it a little bit more as an interaction, because I would venture to guess that the three-year-old by now has figured out what's going on and is purposely doing things to provoke the five-year-old into being a parental-like role. Like maybe purposely when the five-year-old's looking at them, suddenly throw the food on the table or something like that.
Then.
Oh, I thought you said so. Oh, no, fantastic. Okay. But it could still be. It's because it's that close that it has become an interaction, and you may need to address it to the two of them. That I'm sorry to the two of you engaging in this and this and this. Is put it on both of them. Listen, one other thing, by the way, and I didn't mention this earlier. You know, I told you that you have to put the onus of responsibility on them. One other thing that works, I'll give you an example of something I used to do. I mentioned I was a psychologist in a school, and sometimes when there would be a conflict, let's say between two eighth-grade boys or something like that, and usually a big bully, let's say, picking on a younger kid, one of the things I would do is I would get the assistant principal, right, which is the worst job in the world, any assistant principals here. But, you know, you do all the dirty work, you get none of the credit, right? I get an assistant principal to bring them into a room, the two kids, and give it to them. Let them have it. And scream and yell at them and be an absolute SOB with them. And then leave the room and say, and you got 10 minutes to figure out how you're going to get along, or you're both thrown out of this school. Now, what have I accomplished? Accomplished
common
two.
Enemy.
There's nothing that gets two people to get along better than to have a common enemy. My mother says,
but I don't like being hated.
But you're supposed to be. You're the mother. My mother says in Europe they used to call grandchildren sinum fundus sinum. You know, enemies of the enemies. You know, my grandparents, grandchildren get along so that they have a mutual enemy. She calls my kids sinum fundus sinum. You know, that's there's no better way to get along than have a common enemy. So when you take the two kids who are hating each other now, and you send them to the room and say, I said, I've had it. You know, I'm sick and tired of this. I don't want to hear who's right, who's wrong. I don't care. The two of you, blah, 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 blah. Now they hate you more than they hate each other. That's normal. That's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah,
exactly, right. And you're the parent. You're supposed to be hated. So if one way to get, and one of the benefits of treating it in that kind of like collective way, of addressing it, again, I told it putting the onus of responsibility on the kids, but one of the benefits is now they're united. And that, by the way, in the case of the school, one of the other things I did was I took this, like, you know, 4'10" wimp, and I lumped them together with the 6'4" Hulk there. Now it's the two of them. Now the two of them are suddenly bonded. Now this victim is a tough guy because he's in trouble with the bully. So that's one other way. But I would tell you in this kind of situation, if you're addressing your 15-year-old alone hasn't sufficed, maybe you have to look or study it even yourself before you do anything. Next time it happens, kind of just try to check. You might be surprised to find that the younger one is provoking the 15-year-old into that. Okay, so then you put it on both of them. Put them both of them and get them, and then what? And there's nothing wrong if, listen, how many people here have not at some time or another hated, how many people here haven't at some time or another, either their children or themselves, have said they're going to move away from home? Right? I had one cousin once who threatened his parents he was going to move away from home. They saw they weren't impressed. He said, well, I'm going to move away from home and become conservative. You know, I think it's going to up the ante. You know, you sometimes have to hate your parents. If let me put it this way. If anyone here is raising their children don't sometimes hate them, they're not doing their job. That's part of parenting. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, yes, I'm just random.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you consider to be, there's a difference between parentifying and, you know, you want to give them a sense of responsibility and chores and you know,
mm-hmm.
a family duty to be part of mm-hmm. the unit and help out. So when do you consider it to be crossing the line of giving them too much responsibility or what you call parentifying, you know?
Well, when you give them a parental role, that's very easy. Or when they start assuming it themselves. If you're doing your job right with chores, they should refuse to do it and forget about it and cry and scream and resist it. Then they're learning chores. If right away on their own, you know, they're cooking supper before you come home, and they're setting up a behavior chart for the sibling 2 years younger than them, and then that's parentifying. Then they've been parentified, you know. But, you know, the typical chore thing is, you know, take out the garbage, what garbage, you know, and you're always picking on me, then you're giving them chores. Then you're doing the right thing. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
We're having supper, and my five-year-old, he doesn't want to eat supper. He steals the candy. And my wife says, go after him. And she wants me to run after him, get the candy out of his mouth. And I'm like, nah, I'm not having candy.
He's faster than you also, right?
I mean, I can catch him.
That's not sibling rivalry. That's a, let's see, discipline must be one of the other... one of the other issues. You know something? I'll just tell you two things very quickly. Kids, parents can very upset when the kids misbehave. It's the same, you know, like I said before, that you're supposed to be supposed to have rivalry, so they learn how to resolve differences, etc. Kids are supposed to misbehave. Kids, normal kids, because when they misbehave, they give us an opportunity to teach them not to, you know, to control themselves. So the fact that the kid took candy is perfectly normal. The fact that you don't allow it is fine. The only thing you have to be careful about is this running after them. You know, sometimes it gets a little ridiculous because they're faster and they can crawl into places that we can't get into. And, you know, before you know it, you're at the chiropractor. You know, sometimes it's sufficient to say, you know, come back here by so-and-so time or there'll be such and such consequences. Running after a kid is not always the best way. You know, you want him to come back on his own. And the running, especially with a young kid, the being chased becomes almost rewarding in and of itself. Yeah, okay, go ahead. I don't know. You go back there, yeah. Uh-huh. Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm a mother of a 4.5-year-old.
A mother of a 4.5-year-old, is that?
4.5-year-old.
Triplets? Uh-huh, okay. I don't give out medication. There's some psychiatrists here if you want to. No.
I
wanted
to get up for the medical assistance, and they physically also, and I tell them,
you have to what? I couldn't hear him. Sorry.
You're a bad mother.
You're a bad mother. Okay.
Because I don't resolve the issues. I'm 4.5 years old. I can't even. It's like all the important times.
Do you have a return policy with any of them? Can you get your deposit back? Yeah.
I have to call. I sometimes come out in 1 minute. It can be
Yeah. Okay. First of all, the fact that they say you're a bad mommy, please. That's fine. That's a sign that you're a good mommy. Okay? Please don't worry. You know, we think our children have to love us 24/7. Our children have to be raised in such a way that they're successful, competent adults. It doesn't matter if they hate us along the way. They will ultimately love us more. I want to tell you something. I mentioned I'm working in 5 towns. It's a fairly opulent area. I've seen children who've gotten everything they want, and they're miserable adults, and they hate their parents. So the fact that you're putting limits on them, the fact that you're putting pressure on them, and that they hate you is fine. I'm very happy to hear that. What you may be touching upon, which is another issue, which is a delicate one, because it's not always possible. It's also, are they together in one room? Are they? Oh, okay. Because sometimes 3 kids the same age on top of each other a lot can be overbearing, and especially because there's so much commonality. You know, at least with the kids in different ages, there's some discrepant interests. You know, there's different set of friends, different... They share everything, and if they're very much on top of each other, that can be just breeding grounds for excessive rivalry. Maybe you have to try to see if you can separate them out as much as possible. I mean, I'm not one that believes that every kid has to have his own room and, you know, have his own maid. You know, it's not necessary, and kids do very well sharing rooms, etc. But sometimes it can be a little bit too much, and sometimes there is room to... Especially when they're that close... And sharing, and they share so much. They share the same friends. They share the same interests. The same, you know.
But you need to get involved when it's physically.
If it's again, if it, you have to. I mean, again, maybe it's something that's harder for the women, because they, you know, although today girls are physically fighting much more than they used to. But probably when you were a kid, girls didn't physically fight as much. Maybe your husband has to help you with that. There is a sort of etiquette. There's a difference between a kid who punches a kid in an arm and another one punches a kid in the face. I mean, if I can be, you know, it's just that in normal fighting, they kind of know how far to go, and you have to be the judge. If it's really out of hand, and you're really worrying about somebody getting hurt, then you have to be more actively intervene. Absolutely. I don't know if I should, you know, I guess they'll scream at us when time's up. Okay. You were raising hand for a while. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'm an only child.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. That question comes up often. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Always wondering to myself, if these kids have sibling rivals, how... Why would they even love each other? How do they ever mix to love each other if they have
the
competition? Where does that even...
And I'm going to tell you that if it's the normal range of sibling rivalry, and it's managed in such a way that the kids, you know, if it's managed properly and they learn from it, they're going to love each other more because they love each other when they're secure, happy adults. I thought you were going to ask me how to only children deal with the other. Okay, I'm around. Do people have any questions?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hope you have a...
Okay, thank you.